Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix. Tonight I'd like to read some from 1984, George Orwell's 1984, to show you that nothing really is new at all, because Orwell himself, or Blair as his name really was brought up to be one of the sort of managerial class, not the high ones, but really a high bureaucratic class basically. And his father was, I think it was the opium, the governor for the Queen's opium fields in Burma, in fact. And they did have the Queen's opium fields. Now, of course, they have in Afghanistan, and they're well protected by the same troops. But anyway, George Orwell turned against. He was trained to push the socialist drive from university. He fought in the Spanish Civil War, and then he met the real communists and realized that it was all lies, because they were told in Britain the communists were just the same as the socialists in Britain. And he realized there was a bigger hand behind all this, the money boys, everything, and the whole idea of war, what it's really all about, etc. And he wrote 1984 and 1948. The real title of it was The Last Man, because the purpose, of course, is to destroy all manhood as such, especially men who would rebel against dictatorships and things like that. But his publisher demanded a different title, so they changed it to 1984. Throughout the book, of course, you find that Winston, the hero or victim of the whole thing, everybody's a Winston in a sense, who understands what's going on. He's given a book to read, and it's a dictionary, the new dictionary, because they're always making the dictionary narrower and narrower, until if you can't express something, you can't have any revolution if you can't express what you're thinking. And that was part of the whole thing. So you have no thought crime, like New Zealand, their thought crime is if you might go and commit a crime, you think you might do, and then your friends can also be pulled in too, even if they live in different countries. I've got nothing to do with it. But there's a different purpose behind all of this, and he explains it here. In the book is given by Goldstein, who's supposedly the bad guy, the enemy that doesn't exist. The dictionary peels apart, every page peels apart to show you the revolution. And of course, it's a setup to get Winston pulled in and arrested. But anyway, it says this because they're telling the truth. You see, those who ruled in that age, in that period, that place of Brave New World, ran the whole show, so they could afford to be honest before they grab you and torture you. So it says, ignorance is strength, you see. Throughout recorded time, and probably since the end of the Neolithic age, there have been three kinds of people in the world, the high, the middle, and the low. They have been subdivided in many ways. They have borne countless different names, and their relative numbers, as well as their attitude towards one another, have varied from age to age. But the essential structure of society has never altered. Even after enormous upheavals and seemingly irrevocable changes, the same pattern has always reasserted itself. Just as a gyroscope will always return to equilibrium, however far it's pushed one way or the other, the aims of these three groups are entirely irreconcilable. And it also says at the top here, ignorance is strength. You're taught that, you see, ignorance is strength. And it goes on to talk too about, and I'll skip up a couple of pages, but it says here, the aim of modern warfare, in accordance with the principles of doublethink, that's the ability to hold two opposing opinions in your head at the same time. Most folk do have that. The same is simultaneously recognized and not recognized by the directing brains of the inner party, is to use up the products of the machine, production in other words, without raising the general standard of living. And we found that happened in World War One, for instance, and then you end up with a depression. So it uses up the products from basically all the tax money they take from you without giving you anything back at all. In fact, you're left with massive debt. And every shell that's fired, every plane that's shot down has to be replaced, you see. So it says to use up the products of the machine without raising the general standard of living. Ever since the end of the 19th century, the problem of what to do with the surplus of consumption goods has been latent in industrial society. At present, when few human beings even have enough to eat, this problem is obviously not urgent, and it might not have become so even if no artificial process of destruction had been at work. The world of today is a bare, hungry, dilapidated place compared with the world that existed before 1914, and still more so if compared with the imaginary future to which the people of that period looked forward. In the early 20th century, the vision of a future society, unbelievably rich, leisured, orderly and efficient, a glittering antiseptic world of glass and steel and snow-white concrete, was part of the consciousness of nearly every literate person. Science and technology were developing at a prodigious speed, and it seemed natural to assume they would go on developing. Now, every 30, 40 years, they have the same story. They tell you, in the 60s, they showed you people all dressed in Roman togas. That was in all the papers, and how science was going to cure all ills. And it'd be a privilege for the few who would work. You wouldn't need many folk to work, it said. And they've even rehashed the same stuff again. How technology and internet, everything's going to be so much wonderful as we go down the tubes. Anyway, it says, this failed to happen, partly because of the impoverishment caused by a long series of wars and revolutions, partly because scientific and technical progress depended on the empirical belief or habit of thought, which could not survive in a strictly regimented society. As a whole, the world is more primitive today than it was 50 years ago. Certain backward areas have advanced and various devices, always on some way connected with warfare and police espionage, have been developed. That's what we're all about today, police espionage devices. That's all we're working on. Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt, reading some extracts from Orwell's 1984. And he's talking about some development, and how backward areas have advanced. This is all from the book that he was given by one of the elite himself, in order to set him up for being arrested and torturing him as a subversive, which still happens today, I'm sure. Certain backward areas have advanced, and various devices, always in some way connected with warfare and police espionage, have been developed, but experiment and invention have largely stopped, and the ravages of the atomic war of the 1950s have never been fully repaired. Nevertheless, the dangers inherent in the machine are still there. From the moment when the machine first made its appearance, it was clear to all thinking people that the need for human drudgery, and therefore to a great extent for human inequality, had disappeared. If the machine were used deliberately for that end, hunger, overwork, dirt, illiteracy, and disease could be eliminated within a few generations, and in fact, without being used for any such purpose, but by sort of an automatic process, by producing wealth which was sometimes impossible not to distribute. The machine did raise the living standards of the average human being very greatly over a period of about 50 years at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. But it was also clear that an all-round increase in wealth threatened the destruction, indeed, in some sense, what was the destruction of a hierarchical society in a world in which everyone worked short hours, had enough to eat, lived in a house with a bedroom and a refrigerator, and possessed a car or even an airplane. The most obvious and perhaps the most important form of inequality would already have disappeared. If it once became general, wealth would confer no distinction. It was possible, no doubt, to imagine a society in which wealth, in the sense of personal possessions and luxuries, should be evenly distributed, while power remained in the hands of a small privileged caste. But in practice, such a society could not long remain stable, for if leisure and security were enjoyed by all alike, the great mass of human beings who are normally stupefied by poverty would become literate and would learn to think for themselves. And when once they had done this, they would sooner or later realize that the privileged minority had no function, and that they would sweep it away. In the long run, a hierarchical society was only possible on a basis of poverty and ignorance. So you must keep the people in poverty and ignorance, as we know today. To return to the agricultural past, as some thinkers about the beginning of the 20th century dreamed of doing, was not a practical solution. It conflicted with the tendency towards mechanization, which had become quasi-instinctive throughout almost the whole world. And moreover, any country which remained industrial backward was helpless in a military sense and was bound to be dominated directly or indirectly by its more advanced rivals. Nor was it a satisfactory solution to keep the masses in poverty by restricting the output of goods. It happened to a great extent during the final phase of capitalism, roughly between 1920 and 1940. The economy of many countries was allowed to stagnate, Land went out of cultivation, capital equipment was not added to, great blocks of the population were prevented from working and kept half alive by state charity, but this too entailed military weakness, and since the privations it inflicted were obviously unnecessary, it made opposition inevitable. The problem was how to keep the wheels of industry turning without increasing the real wealth of the world. Goods must be produced, but they need not be distributed. And in practice, the only way of achieving this was by continuous warfare. The essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. Look at the price of each jet they have there, and even the missiles they fire, and so on. War is a way of shattering to pieces or pouring into the stratosphere or sinking in the depths of the sea materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable, and hence in the long run too intelligent. Even when weapons of war are not actually destroyed, their manufacture is still a convenient way of expending labor power without producing anything that can be consumed. A floating fortress, for example, has locked it up in the harbor that would build several hundred cargo ships just to make this super fortress. Ultimately, it is scrapped as obsolete, never having brought any material benefit to anybody, and with further enormous labors, another floating fortress is built, Mark 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, etc. And that's what you've got now. You had that all through the Cold War, same thing. Oh, the Russians have this new missile. Oh, we've got to get the cash and build one equal to it and even better. And then back and forth and back and forth until you had all these multimillionaires who were in the House of Lords and some of them in the Parliament too, the Commons, who were in on it too, and they had massive shares in it. Great. And so did the Russians on the other side, mind you, worked both ways. So you always have the dominant minority profiting off of this stuff while they dish out nothing to the public except debt, you see. And so they love war. They love war for this kind of stuff. And look at all the things they've made even for the Gulf War and onwards. You know, the bunker bursting bombs and they've got battlefield nukes that they can use in a small scale, all that stuff. And they think it's great. And you get a big bang and there's another $5 million or $10 million bomb you've got to replace. That's great, isn't it? So it talks about that. Plus, that might exist after meeting the bare needs of the population. In practice, the needs of the population are always underestimated, with the result that there is a chronic shortage of half the necessities of life. But this is looked on as an advantage. It is deliberate policy to keep even the favoured groups somewhat near the brink of hardship, because a general state of scarcity increases the importance of small privileges and thus magnifies the distinction between one group and another. And of course, in Russia, all the bureaucrats and Politburo, etc., everybody who worked for a government lived at an equivalent level of all their opposition in the West. There's nothing they couldn't get, just the general population that lived in scarcity. But you also had all these different privileges at the top as well. Nevertheless, the few luxuries that he does enjoy, his large, well-appointed flat, the better texture of his clothes, the better quality of his food and drink and tobacco, his two or three servants, his private motor car or helicopter, set him in a different world from a member of the outer party, somebody the inner party. And the members of the outer party have a similar advantage in comparison with the submerged masses who we call the proles. The social atmosphere is that of a besieged city, where the possession of a lump of horse flesh makes a difference between wealth and poverty, and at the same time the consciousness of being at war and therefore in danger makes the handing over of all power to a small caste, as their elite, seem the natural, unavoidable condition of survival. So that's why they bring it in. You're all in danger, you're all in danger, only we can save you, you see. And it's happened over and over right up to the present. War, it will be seen, not only accomplishes the necessary destruction, but accomplishes it in a psychologically acceptable way. In principle, it would be quite simple to waste the surplus labor of the world by building temples and pyramids, by digging holes and filling them up again, or even by producing vast quantities of goods and then setting fire to them. But this would provide only the economic and not the emotional basis for a hierarchical society. So there's got to be an emotional basis for you to obey them, you see. What is concerned here is not the morale of the masses, whose attitude is unimportant so long as they are kept steadily at work, but the morale of the party itself. Even the humblest party members expected to be competent, industrious, and even intelligent within narrow limits, but it's also necessary that he should be a credulous and ignorant fanatic, whose prevailing moods are fear, hatred, adulation, and orgiastic triumph. In other words, it is necessary that he should have the mentality appropriate to a state of war. And you can listen to these talking heads from all governments today that are put in charge of the wars, and they have to be fanatical about it. And they are. They're fanatical. So much so that they say it with anger when they're questioned about taking all the people's rights away. They're very angry when they get questioned about that. So the inner party and the outer party must be fanatics. It does not matter whether the war is actually happening, and since no decisive victory is possible, it does not matter whether the war is going well or badly. All that is needed is that a state of war should exist. The splitting of the intelligence which the party requires of its members, and which is more easily achieved in an atmosphere of war, is now almost universal. But the higher up the ranks one goes, the more marked it becomes. It is precisely in the inner party that war hysteria and hatred of the enemy are strongest. In his capacity as an administrator, it is often necessary for a member of the inner party to know that this or that item of war news is untruthful, and he may often be aware that the entire war is spurious and is either not happening or is being waged for purposes quite other than the declared ones. But such knowledge is easily neutralized by the technique of doublethink. You remember them all going up there, weapons of mass destruction. Colin Powell looked absolutely ashamed at one point, but he went right back in it again and doublethink. He knew it was all a lie. His belief in the party gave him the right to lie about it, even to himself. Meanwhile, no inner party members wavers for an instant in his mystical belief that the war is real and that it is bound to end victoriously. So the technique, as I say, is ancient, and what happens with the inner and the outer party is always the same. The proles at the bottom just adapt because they're told they're going to be all slaughtered and etc. if they don't back them. They want to be safe. Nothing changes, eh? Nothing ever changes. So it says here, there are therefore two problems which the party is concerned to solve. One is how to discover against his will what another human being is thinking. Now listen, I'll say this again. This is an important little part here. One is how to discover, this is for the party to be concerned about and to solve. One is how to discover against his will what another human being is thinking, and the other is how to kill several hundred million people in a few seconds without giving warning beforehand. That's what really occupies those who are up in the elite. That's why they must have so much surveillance, because they're obsessed always, even before electronics. They're obsessed and know what others are thinking. You see? Another part is if things get out of hand, how do they deal with all those people? You've got to kill them fast. There's many ways to do it today. And it says, insofar as scientific research still continues, that is a subject matter. The scientist of today is either a mixture of psychologist and inquisitor, studying with extraordinary minuteness the meaning of facial expressions. This was written in 48. So you've got all this stuff now done in airports, right? Oh my goodness, you're looking at, you've got a frown on you, sir. What's on your mind? Then they take you and interrogate you. And they try to call it a science. Starting with the extraordinary minutes, the meaning of facial expressions, gestures, and tones of voice. You've got all that going on all the time now. And testing the truth-producing effects of drugs, shock therapy, hypnosis, and physical torture. Or he is a chemist, physicist, or biologist concerned only with such branches of his special subject as are relevant to the taking of life. Yep. The most paid scientists you've got in the world are all working on creating new viruses to kill in biowarfare labs, or new things to blow you up, even death rays and all the rest of it too. They're the best paid people of all in every country. Not the ones who are trying to find real cures for things. So it says, the testing of the truth-producing effects of drugs, shock therapy, hypnosis, and physical torture, or he's a chemist, physicist, or biologist concerned only with such branches of his special subjects as are relevant to the taking of life. In the vast laboratories of the Ministry of Peace, which is really the Ministry of War, because all it's all about making peace, right? And in experimental stations hidden in the Brazilian forests or in the Australian desert or in lost islands of the Antarctic, the teams of experts are indefatigably at work. Some are concerned simply with planning the logistics of future wars. Others devise larger and larger rocket bombs, more and more powerful explosives and more impenetrable armor plating. Others search for new and deadlier gases or for soluble poisons capable of being introduced in such quantities as to destroy the vegetation of whole continents or for breeds of disease. It's like Agent Orange when he sprayed it all over Vietnam to kill all vegetation so they could see the enemy. And of course, you know, the people came down with massive cancers and deformed children and all the rest of it. And those guys were never ever questioned about their work because they're working for the country, right? They were working for peace by stopping a war, by killing everybody. Anyway, it says, or for soluble poisons capable of being produced in such quantities as to destroy the vegetation of whole continents, or for breeds of disease, germs immunized against all possible antibodies. In other words, germs you couldn't destroy. Others strive to produce a vehicle that shall bore its way under the soil like a submarine under the water. That's the RAND Corporation, they actually have them. Or an airplane as independent of its base as a sailing ship. Others explore even remoter possibilities such as focusing the sun's rays through lenses suspended thousands of kilometers away in space or producing artificial earthquakes and tidal waves by tapping the heat of the Earth's center. So they've always got these massive scientific projects on the go, but in reality, when you look behind them, it's either for their own survival as a place to hide, or means of detecting people who are dissenters, or by killing us all off. That's what war is really all about. And even when you think you're in peacetime, that war is always going on. Always going on. In all countries. And it's also got... The war, therefore, if we judge by the standards of previous wars, is merely an imposture. It's like the battles between certain ruminant animals whose horns are set at such an angle that they're incapable of hurting one another. Although it is unreal, it's not meaningless. It eats up the surplus of consumable goods, and it helps to preserve the special mental atmosphere that a hierarchical society needs. War, it will be seen, is now a purely internal affair. In the past, the ruling groups of all countries, although they might recognize their common interest and therefore limit the destructiveness of war, did fight against one another, and the victor always plundered the vanquished. In our own day, they are not fighting against one another at all. The war is waged by each ruling group against its own subjects, the people. And the object of war is not to make or prevent conquest of territory, but to keep the structure of society intact. The very word war, therefore, has become misleading. It would probably be accurate to say that by becoming continuous war, war has ceased to exist. The particular pressure that it exerted on human beings between the Neolithic age and the early 20th century has disappeared and has been replaced by something quite different. The effect would be much the same if the three superstates, instead of fighting one another, should agree to live in perpetual peace. Each inviolates within its own boundaries. For in that case, each would still be a self-contained universe, freed forever from the sobering influence of external danger. A peace that was truly permanent would be the same as a permanent war. This, although the vast majority of party members understand it only in a shallower sense, is the inner meaning of the party slogan, which is "War is peace," you see. And we hear all of these different phrases coming out of presidents and prime ministers' mouths as they pick the next targets, of course, to bring peace to the world or democracy and all the rest of the rubbish that they talk about. Because we've never had peace and we've never had democracy. Never. We never have had democracy at all. Hasn't existed. And you have to, as I say, read this particular book, George Orwell's 1984, because you got to understand, he actually tells you the mindsets of each class of people and why, let's say, the bottom class go along with everything and how the elites are always looking for new wars and terrifying the public. They're going to be dissolved into the atmosphere within the latest terror threat, whoever it happens to be. And here's an article. He's some... good stuff here, actually, from George Orwell's 1984. Because, you see, George Orwell was groomed for the same kind of position in the high-ups, managing the public. In fact, he was the chief propagandist for the BBC during World War II. And it's possible, actually, he wrote the book because they kind of dropped him after that. I think he may have wanted to go higher. It's very possible. But he lets the same thing out if you understand how to read and what you're reading. He says here, this is the part about the part about the truth, where he's given the dictionary with the second pages stuck to it that tells you the real system, although he's been set up by O'Brien, who is in the inner party. And it's just like the CFR, in fact, which of course he's really referring to. There's an inner party and an outer party of the Royal Institute of International Affairs too. And it says, but the problems of perpetuating a hierarchical society go deeper than this. This is page 184. There are only four ways in which a ruling group can fall from power. Either it is conquered from without, or it is governed so inefficiently that the masses are stirred to revolt, or it allows a strong and discontented middle group to come into being. It says, or loses its own self-confidence and willingness to govern. In the past, you see, in the Middle Ages, the elite were very spoiled, incredibly spoiled, didn't they? You go around having world meetings and all that. And it often became so lazy and lackadaisical that others could take over. And it says, a ruling class which could guard against all of them would remain in power permanently. Ultimately, the determining factor is the mental attitude of the ruling class itself. After the middle of the present century, the first danger had in reality disappeared. Each of the three powers which now divide the world, this is 1948, talking about a three-block governing system of the whole world, just like we're in today. And it says, each of them, the three powers which now divide the world, is in fact unconquerable and could only become conquerable through slow democratic changes which a government with wide powers can easily avert. The second also danger is also a theoretical one. The masses never revolt of their own accord. That is history. And they never revolt merely because they are oppressed. Indeed, so long as they are not permitted to have standards of comparison, they never even become aware that they are oppressed. Do you understand, during the 20th century, you could always see how other countries lived and the standards of living. Now you're not seeing it so much. So you have nothing to compare. As you go down in your drastically reduced consumption, that's part of the agenda of a post-consumerist society now, you see. You have nothing to compare it to. And if anything, actually, you'll be comparing it to the rising standards of a few, really, in India and Brazil and elsewhere. And they're their own elites. You watch them go up. Even more stinking rich than they are already. The recurrent economic crisis of past times were totally unnecessary and are not now permitted to happen. But other and equally large dislocations can and do happen without having political results, because there is no way in which discontent can become articulate. You understand? I remember watching one of the big meetings against the G20. And I think it was held in London. And one of the politicians actually came forward in the crowd. You may remember it yourselves. And he asked them, what were they angry about? And none of them could verbalize the real problem. They were all angry. It's a multiple anger. And when they're angry, they can't even fix their minds into articulating what's wrong. It's everything to them. Everything's wrong. But they can't say what it is specifically, because often they don't know. And it says here, they never even become aware that they are oppressed. The current economic crisis of past times were totally necessary, blah, blah, blah. And they can't articulate it. As for the problem of overproduction, which has been latent in our society since the development of machine technique, it is solved by the device of continuous warfare. How long have you been at war? Do you remember Gulf War I? It's ongoing. I read the article from the military magazine too on continuous perpetual war. That's what you've got from now on. And if it's not war, overt war outside, you see, it's war on you in airports and everywhere else, and cops are getting more powers and so on. And they can be at war with you. Because one of the prime reasons for warfare is to change society by those who own it. Anyway, it says here, as for the problem of overproduction, it's been overcome, blah, 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 because it's solved by the device of continuous warfare, which is also useful for in keying up public morale to the necessary pitch. Do you remember the Green Party in Britain two or three years ago? She's really talking about post-consumer society. But she says, we've got to get the public ready for this. And she says, if we can get them to the same war mentality as they had in World War II, when they would accept rationing, accept being hard up, no little cash, and accept being ruled in a non-democratic fashion, She says, then we can get this through, this global society of post-consumerist society. And it says here, continuous warfare is also keying up from public morality to the necessary pitch. From the point of view of her present rulers, therefore, only the genuine dangers are the splitting off of a new group of able, underemployed, power-hungry people and the growth of liberalism and scepticism in their own ranks. The problem that it is to say is educational. It is a problem of continuously molding the consciousness both of the directing group and of the larger executive group that lies immediately below it. The consciousness of this of the masses need only to be influenced in a negative way. That's basically what Isaiah Berlin was teaching Tony Blair and others, many others before him and after him. At least before him, I should say. And in other words, you've got to make sure that the upper classes and your upper middle class who help run the world for their masters will push things forward. And he's talking about things really much like conservation, eating less, and don't you're told, all I've got is GM food now to save the world. Utter rubbish, because the same bankers own the GM industry. They own pretty well all of the farming industries. A small percentage now in private hands. That had a war on the farmer for 40 odd years or more. And they make sure that the people at the bottom are given the most dumbed down, the proles they call them, of course, here, dumbed down education. And it's a book you've got to basically read right through. You'll enjoy it too. It's far more deeper, of course, than the movies can be. There's two movies out on it. But it goes into detail of how society is actually run. And it says here, in another page here, it says, its rulers are not held together by blood ties, but by adherence to a common doctrine. You understand, if you're upper middle class and you're psychopathic, you'll sniff the wind. You know where your benefit lies for yourself. And you get in on it, you see. And you will parrot, as though it was gospel truth from a deity itself, that's like global warming. Doesn't matter how much evidence you bring against it, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. There's no dissent amongst their own ranks. Because they know that. They're out the door if it happens. So its rules are not held together. But it's true that our society is stratified and very rigidly stratified on what at first sight might appear to be hereditary lines. Well, there's definitely hereditary lines in a certain bunch of them at the top. There's far less to and fro movement between different groups than happened under capitalism or even in the pre-industrial ages. Between the two branches of the party, there's a certain amount of interchange, but only so much as will ensure that weaklings are excluded from the inner party and the ambitious members of the outer party are made harmless by allowing them to rise. Proletarians, in practice, the ordinary folk, are not allowed to graduate into the party. The most gifted amongst them, who might possibly become nuclei of discontent, are simply marked down by the thought police and eliminated. What was it, Lord Bertrand Russell said the same thing? Those who we can recruit in by scholarships into the granite halls of Oxford and Cambridge, he says, those who will not go along with us and who are bright, basically, would have to be extirpated, same thing, eliminated. Killed, in other words. And it says, but this state of affairs is not necessarily permanent, nor is it a matter of principle. The party is not a class in the old sense of the word. It does not aim at transmitting power to its own children as such, and if there were no other way of keeping the ablest people at the top, it would be perfectly prepared to recruit an entire new generation from the ranks of the proles. In the crucial years, the fact that the party was not a hereditary body did a great deal to neutralize opposition. The older kind of socialist who had been trained to fight against something called class privilege assumed that what is not hereditary cannot be permanent. He did not see that the continuity of an oligarchy need not be physical, nor did he pause to reflect that the hereditary aristocracies have always been short-lived, whereas adoptive organizations such as the Catholic Church have sometimes lasted for hundreds or thousands of years. Quigley mentions this too. He says foundations that can run the world don't have to change. You can set up a goal, like dominating the world on this sector. The foundations are all specialists in their own areas. And they can hire generation after generation after generation of guys who come in, take their little vow and the whole bit, and continue on their part of the world agenda. Doesn't matter which parties come and go. They come and go and come and go. It doesn't matter. The foundations can stick on with trillions of dollars to back them all. and get the agenda through. But you see, a ruling group is a ruling group so long as it can nominate its successors. The party is not concerned with perpetuating its blood, but with perpetuating itself. Who wields power is not important, provided that the hierarchical structure remains always the same. Same guys at the top above your prime ministers and presidents, you see. All the beliefs, habits, tastes, emotions, mental attitudes that categorize our time are really designed to sustain the mystique of the party and prevent the true nature of present-day society from being perceived. Physical rebellion or any preliminary move towards rebellion is at present not possible. From the proletarians, nothing is to be feared. From the people at the bottom, the ordinary people, there's nothing to be feared. Left to themselves, they will continue from generation to generation, from century to century, working, breeding, and dying, not only without any impulse to rebel, but without the power of grasping that the world could be other than it is. It's important that they can't grasp that the world could be other than it is. In fact, the ideas that it could be better are that from the politicians to the proles at the bottom. The proles believe it because they won't do it themselves. They can only become dangerous if the advance of industrial technique, it's a technique of controlling everything, made it necessary to educate them more highly. That's when they become dangerous. But since military and commercial rivalry are no longer important, the level of popular education is actually declining. 1948. What opinions the masses hold or do not hold is looked on as a matter of indifference. They can be granted intellectual liberty because they have no intellect. In a party member, on the other hand, not even the smallest deviation of opinion on the most unimportant subject can be tolerated. And that's why you won't find a single individual who's put up there to push the global warming agenda, climate change agenda, which is redistribution of wealth from all the countries to the banks themselves, not to the poor. That's why not one of them, actually they're all like clones of each other, because they have the same prattle, the political speak prattle, and they've learned it all off by heart. They can't deviate with their own personal opinion on anything. They're like robots when they speak. A party member lives from birth to death under the eye of the thought police. And now it's true. You see, if people who are important to this system, to run the system without too much of a hassle happening in their time, are more spied upon than the general public. It's more, see, if one of them broke ranks, then it's an important person has broken ranks and spoken the truth. They can't allow that. When the Soviet Union fell, of course, they did lots of documentaries on it. They go into the archives in the Politburo, and they mentioned that it's more important to bug all the homes, etc., and keep track of all the people that work for them in the bureaucracy than the proles at the bottom. There's nothing to fear from the proles. And that's the payoff, of course. That's the ones at the top now. I'm talking about the top, the ones that we see, which are really employees. Right to the Strauss Kahns and everybody else. They're heavily, heavily watched. And believe you me, when they bring them down for some reason, it's not because of what they did that we're told. It's because of something that they didn't pass on to their bosses above, because all the big deals are passed on upwards. So it says here, nothing that he does is indifferent. His friendships, his relaxations, his behavior toward his wife and children, the expression of his face when he's alone, the words he mutters in sleep, even the characteristic movements of his body are all jealously scrutinized. Not only any actual misdemeanor, but any eccentricity, however small, any change of habits, any nervous mannerism that could possibly be the symptom of an inner struggle is certain to be detected. Now, they're doing that with us all now because we're all potential terrorists and criminals, you see. And, of course, in this book, if you read it, you'll find out that everybody's spied on all the time, with a big screen in your home and with cameras in your home and so on, which, of course, is where they're all going with us. In fact, you'll buy them. That's the only difference. You'll buy them. In that article I read last week or so, it was about, I think, Toshiba. One of the big companies are putting cameras to watch you. But actually, they've been doing that for years and years and years without telling you. And you'll invite it into your home, you see. So it says here, on the other hand, his actions are not regulated by law or by any clearly formulated code of behavior. In Oceania, there's no law. Thoughts and actions which, when detected, mean certain death and not for formally forbidden. And the endless purges, arrests, tortures, imprisonments, and vaporizations are not inflicted as punishment for crimes which have actually been committed, but are merely the wiping out of persons who might perhaps commit a crime at some time in the future. And you think that the Minority Report movie was a breakthrough? Here's 1948. A party member is required to have not only the right opinions, but the right instincts. They're psychopathic. They sniff the winning side, you see. Many of the beliefs and attitudes demanded of him are never plainly stated and could not be stated without laying bare the contradictions inherent in, he calls it INSOC, that the system itself you're living under. If he's a person naturally orthodox, in Newspeak, a good thinker, they call it, he got this all from the Frankfurt School, by the way. They had these terms. They used them in the Frankfurt School, which runs still up there today, running at your culture. Like good and ungood. But in any case, an elaborate mental training undergone in childhood and grouping itself around the Newspeak words crime stop, black, white, and doublethink makes him unwilling and unable to think too deeply on any subject whatsoever. So what you've really got is a totally controlled, managed system from birth to death across the world. It has to be uniform. That's why Reuters gives every country their news. Back with more after this break. Hi folks, I'm back, cutting through the matrix, reading a few books that are very, very important to understand because, as I say, this kind of book is kind of leaked out by people who were trained for their particular jobs in the ruling society of the world. And I'm talking from childhood too. And of course, we know that Blair or Orwell actually came from an intergenerational class of bureaucrats, as they generally are. And so in page 182, he talks about how they had wars after wars after wars in order to get the world system together, which is exactly what we've gone through. In fact, Quigley goes even further from the records of them, and from the Boer War onwards, he says not a single war wasn't started by this group behind the scenes to get world government, you see. It says here in 182, it says, it was only after a decade of national wars, civil wars, revolutions, and counter-revolutions in all parts of the world that INSOC and its rivals emerged as fully worked-out political theories. But they had been foreshadowed by the various systems, generally called totalitarian, which had appeared earlier in the century, and the main outlines of the world, which would emerge from the prevailing chaos, had long been obvious. What kind of people would control this world had been equally obvious. The new aristocracy was made up for the most part of, now, we've mentioned technocrats many times here on this particular broadcast. What kind of people would make up this world had been equally obvious. The new aristocracy was made up for the most part of bureaucrats, scientists that are appointed bureaucrats now, they're called technocrats. Experts, technicians, trade union organizers, of course, they had them in their bag for a long time. Technicians, trade union organizers, publicity experts, they run the system, an awful lot of work for them. Sociologists, teachers, journalists, and professional politicians. These people, whose origins lay in the salaried middle class and the upper grades of the working class, had been shaped and brought together by the barren world of monopoly, industry, and centralized government. As compared with their opposite numbers in past ages, they were less avaricious, less tempted by luxury, hungrier for pure power, and above all, more conscious of what they were doing and more intent on crushing opposition. This last difference was cardinal by comparison with what of that existing today. He says, all the tyrannies of the past were half-hearted and inefficient. The ruling groups were always infected to some extent by liberal ideas and were content to leave loose ends everywhere, to regard only the overt act and to be uninterested in what the subjects were thinking. Even the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages was tolerant by modern standards. Part of the reason for this was that in the past, no government had the power to keep its citizens under constant surveillance. This is 1948. From a guy who was reared to be part of this governing class. The invention of print, however, made it easier to manipulate public opinion, and film and radio carried the process further with the development of television and the technical advance which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument. Private life came to an end. What have you had over the last few years here? Privacy's dead. The internet, etc. Every citizen, or at least every citizen important enough to be worth watching, could be kept for 24 hours a day under the eyes of the police and in the sound of official propaganda, with all other channels of communication closed. The possibility of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity of opinion on all subjects now existed for the first time. And then he goes into, again, basically standardizing of public opinion, which they do through Reuters, etc. So that these are the books you've got to read as well. There's many of them to understand what's happened in the past, in your lifetime, what's happening now, where they're going with it, and how they'll train you to go along with it without even knowing. From myself, Alan Ward, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.